was there illness in the camp?
Well, the two things that probably were most prevalent were there was always a lot of diarrhea, and there were people, particularly people that have been there for any length of time, would get a lot of water in their legs. They would show you, they would press on the flesh, and the flesh would just stay pressed, particularly on the legs. Matter of fact, my uncle had that, and that was probably the main reason he didn't survive. I didn't march with him. I wasn't in the same building where he lived at that time, and he never made it through the first march, and he probably couldn't take the march because his legs were very bad. They were just all swollen up with water. That was a very big problem there. And of course, there were probably a lot of different kind of things that happened in the population. But those are the two things that I seem to recall that were quite prevalent.
Do you recall the psychological state of others and yourself?
Well, I was pretty young at the time. And I suppose I was 17 when I went in, 18 when I was liberated. And I was really hoping that someday I'll survive this thing. My biggest thing was always trying to survive. I was always trying to find some extra food. One time, I remember that this was not in Auschwitz, this was in Melk. They had a pigsty near the guardhouse, and they would throw the slop for the pigs. And I would always go by there, look for an opportunity to get in there and get some of that food. I was hungry. And once I had an opportunity, I got in there and I took some bread that was all soaked, and I took it away from the pigs and I ate it. You became concerned with one thing only. At first, things were not too bad. As I told you at first, I even found time to make a chess set and play chess. But as time went on, things became progressively worse. And the final point was that you were only thinking of one thing, and that was, how am I going to survive? At that point, there was only one person that you were concerned about.
Were there medical experiments?
Well, from what I know now, yes, but I was never exposed to any, and I never knew of any at the time. But luckily, I got out of that hospital, and I would have known of it firsthand.
Were you able to keep track of time?
Time didn't mean anything. It was totally meaningless. We would know, in Auschwitz, we would know when the days, because we wouldn't work on Sunday. We would work 6 days. So we would always know when, and we would always look forward to Sunday. But later on, particularly in the last camp, we no longer worked. We were too weak. We were just left there. They were just leaving us alone because we were dying. And at that point in time, I lost track of time at that point. I had no idea what day it was. And I didn't care what day it was.
Do you recall any religious activity?
Yes, I do. At the beginning, there were some people that still practiced and would pray by memory. And as a matter of fact, when we first got there, you know, it was a couple of days before Shavuot. And at that time, all of us, you know, more or less made a religious service when nobody was watching. But as time went on, you didn't bother with it anymore.
When there were bombings, did you have anything at that point?
When they were what?
You said that at one point they were bombing Auschwitz.
Yeah.
Did you have any prayers or see anybody praying at that point?
I didn't.
That's what I'm asking.
No, I didn't.
Okay. Was there any cultural activity?
None.
Did you receive any special punishment?
I got beaten up a couple of times. But I was more fortunate than others. I managed to stay out of the way. I've always looked out. I always tried to be as far away from the cop or the Germans. Wherever they went, I always went the opposite direction. And I managed to stay out of their way most of the time.
Did you witness any special punishment?
Yes. I saw some hangings. There were a few people that escaped. And they were always caught. Nobody ever escaped, as far as I know, from Auschwitz, at least not while I was there. And what they would do is they would bring him out there and publicly hang him. And they would bring out everybody. They had a big square there. And they would line up everybody. And you had to stand there while they hung. And you had to watch them. And they would leave them hang there for a day, whatever. Special punishment. I've seen many people beaten up where they were unconscious, where they dragged them away, and I saw a lot of cruelty. Saw a lot of cruelty from the capos, and I saw a lot of cruelty from the Germans.
Were there any differences between, okay, here comes another one I'm going to mispronounce, the Wehrmacht guards and the SS?
Wehrmacht. Yeah, that was the regular army, and the SS were the volunteers. Yes, in the main, there was a big difference. Now one of the sergeants, he was a Wehrmacht, and I can't remember his name, he was a very famous sergeant, as a matter of fact. He was a Wehrmacht. He was, I believe that the people that they had for those kind of duties, they had to be basically sadistic. They must have picked them very carefully, because they seemed to enjoy what they were doing. They would go out of the way to inflict cruelty on some people, but just walking by. Basically, I would say that the most of the people around us were SS. Once in a while, we would see some Wehrmacht, but most of the people were SS.
Did you see any difference in the way they treated you?
I don't think any of them were very pleasant, but. Probably not.
On the march that you took, you were on a couple of them, weren't you?
Yes.
All right. Well, you can answer it according to each one. They gave you any food or water?
When we would start out, they would give us a loaf of bread. For five people. In other words, you got one loaf of bread for a line of five people. And we were supposed to divide that for whatever length that march took. We had no idea how long it was going to take. As far as water was concerned, it was plenty of snow. We just, every once in a while, you would stop because the Germans would get tired. The guys that were walking us, when they got tired, they would stop, and then we would stop. And then we had a chance to grab some snow. And actually, we didn't have that much to eat, so we weren't all that thirsty. It was interesting. We were going through this. This was on our second march when we were in Austria. We were going through a village, and some of the people would see us. We were going through this village, and all of a sudden they saw all this. These ratchets, I guess, racks, or whatever. We must have really looked terrible. And so when they saw us coming through there, they ran into the house. There were civilians, and they came out with some water, with some tea with some bread. They tried to give it to us, and of course the guards wouldn't let them. They started shooting in the air and driving him off. But there were some people that tried to help us when we walked through the village.
There's no time, they helped you. That question keeps popping up and it keeps leaving. It'll come back, I guess. Oh, I know. You had said before that if you couldn't march, they would shoot you. Do you know what happened to the people who were left on the track dead?
I have no idea. But as we walked through there, there were some column that walked before us. They were frozen bodies that were lying there that had to be there for a while. So I don't know what happened eventually, but I would imagine that they didn't care too much because the Russians were right behind us. I don't think they were worried about picking up the bodies or anything like that. That's my personal opinion.
How did you survive?
As I told you, I managed to go through this thing here, and when I finally survived, I was just a walking skeleton. And this all happened in 1 year's time.
How large were you when you went into the concentration camp?
How large?
Size-wise, just to give me an idea of you're talking.
I don't know.
Weight-wise is what I meant.
No.
Hard question.
I don't know.
Okay, it was just when you keep you talk about how thin you got. I was curious the other day.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. I was a healthy 17-year-old. I really don't know how much.
Show
I weighed.
Us a picture of how thin you were when you came out of the camp.
Okay, we'll look at that later. Why do you think you survived?
I had a will to survive. I fought all the way. I never gave up. Even when I was to the point where I could hardly move, I never survived. I never gave up. I wanted to survive. At that point, we were beginning to hear rumors we knew that we were several times we were marched off, so obviously the Germans were losing. And somewhere along the line, we heard about the invasion, you know, about the landings in Normandy and so forth. And so we knew that eventually if we live long enough we're going to survive. When was the Normandy landing? I don't remember. That must have happened before. So and of course we knew that the Russians were moving up. That the Russians were close to us when they took us away, when they took us originally to the camp, and then twice we had to evacuate the concentration camp. So we knew the reason why. And so we just kept fighting, hoping to survive. That last camp was... I found a piece of coal one day on the ground, plain coal. And of course, we knew that the Germans made margarine out of coal. And so I decided they can get margarine out of it, so can I. And I ate a piece of coal. And of course, I got constipated. For whatever there was to constipate. That's what I got out of it. I don't know, maybe I got some margarine out of it, I don't know. But I ate a piece of coal. We had a lot of pine trees in that camp, and people would scrape the pine tree, the fuzz of the tree, and take a piece of paper and roll it, make a cigarette out of it and smoke that. I mean, it looked like tobacco, so it must have been tobacco. You absolutely couldn't find a blade of grass in that camp. I mean, we just grazed it. Anything we could get a hold of. It didn't make any difference what it was. We were hungry.
Were you aware that they had blown up the crematories and
I was never aware of that. Maybe I was. Yeah, there were rumors about that. That they blew up the crematorium. Yes, I recall it now. Yes. But you see, we were not in the same camp. The crematorium was in Birkenau, and we were in Auschwitz. And even though there was only a few kilometers apart, it wasn't different. It could have been on Mars. Mm.
It was a distance. Did you help each other on the march?
Well, we held on to each other, arm in arm, you know, we locked arms. And we walked like that because we know the consequences if you don't continue walking. And as I told you before, we slept. And perhaps as we slept and walked, maybe one of us was awake all the time and guided the rest of us. I wasn't aware of it. But I know that while I walked, I slept. And if you had to urinate, you just, as you walked along, you just urinate. You didn't dare stop, because if you stopped, they shot you. Sometimes you did stop, and then you could do it, but if you had to do it while you were walking, we were so weak, I mean, if you had to go, you had to go, you couldn't hold it back.
Mm-hmm.
And it was...
On to the liberation.
Pardon me?
On to the liberation.
Okay.
Ebensee? You were in Ebensee when you were liberated?
Yeah, Ebensee. Let's see. It should be spelled out here. Here.
Right. Okay. That's the same way I found it. Okay.
See, that was a satellite camp of Mauthausen. Ebensee. Both Melk and Ebensee were satellite camps off Mauthausen.
Hmm. Does that mean that they were in the same area, like within a kilometer
or
two?
Well, just like Auschwitz had many satellite camps. You know, there were certain camps that were the main camps, and then there were the satellite camps that that actually were under the command of the main camp. And there was Auschwitz, there was Mauthausen, there was Bergen-Belsen, those were the main camps.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were many satellite camps.
Were they in the same area of the...
Yes, generally they would be in the same geographical area.
You were liberated by the Americans?
Yes.
Were there any friends or family with you?
No. There is one man that lives here in town that, he lives in Oak Park, that was liberated with me. He's the only one that I know from that particular camp.
What did you do after you were liberated?
At first, gained my strength back. They more or less brought us back when practically on baby food. Once the occupation force, the American Army, realized what happened to the people that ate the regular food, they realized that they had to give us special consideration, and perhaps they had the experience at other camps that they had liberated. And you have to realize that the first people that came in contact with us were not medical people. These were just average GIs. And they were just trying to do what they felt was the right thing to do, and of course, it turned out it wasn't. But when the medical people came in, of course, I remember a number of ambulances pulled in almost immediately after that fiasco, and they gave us some very light foods, some light cereals and different things like that. And they brought us slowly, they nursed us back, and it didn't take all that long before we were able to take regular cooking. And then we were there for a short period of time. I must have been released, was liberated on the 5th, and this particular document is dated the 28th. And I'm not sure whether there was a day when I left the camp or almost immediately thereafter. So according to this here, I was there for about 3 weeks after we were liberated.
Mm-hmm.
And with this document, I was able to go back to my original home. This was, I could cross any border at that time with this, get on any public transportation with this particular document. It was free transportation. And they were, at different places, the joint, the American Joint Committee, and the, I think basically was the Joint Committee. They have places where you could go and lodge, and you could go and have a meal. They gave you some clothing, and generally assisted you to get back home. where you came originally. And when I got back home, I had heard that my father and my brother had survived. My brother escaped, and through that escape, he was able to save my father, who was really left for dead. And I found out that they had gone back home, so of course I headed back home. And when I got back to my home, I found that the area was occupied by the Russians. It was no longer Czechoslovakia. It was that part was actually today it's part of the Russian Ukraine. This was part of the one of the Yalta or Potsdam agreements that Roosevelt made with Stalin. And when I found that I found my father there, my brother had gone looking for me. So we had crossed paths. And I found my father there, and when I saw that the Russians were there, I didn't want to have anything to do with that, and I immediately stayed only there a couple of days and I left. I went to Praha, which is the capital city of Czechoslovakia, and eventually found my way back to Germany, and my father and my brother came there and eventually we migrated to the United States.
Can you read me what this document says?
Well,
now come the glasses.
It gives my name. It says Mandel.
What is this
know,
up here?
Oh, Ausweis. This is, you have it both in German and in English. So you have Ausweis in German and certification in English. And then Herr means Mister.
Oh, uh-huh.
And Geva means born. And everything that you see here actually is translated in both German and English. This gives you my home address before they was taken away. Oh, this, here we go. That's why I remember the 17th.
What does it say?
That means I was incarcerated from 17th of May 1944.
Well, that's what the 17th.
That's what the 17th is for.
What does this word mean? Word bomb.
From. That means incarcerated from.
Okay. And this means to?
Yes. May 5th, 1945. That's my birthday.
In national?
That means in nationalization, concentration, Lager, Gefangen. It means I was a Gefangen means interned. I was captured in Gefangen. And this, of course, is all liberated. In that here, a Freiheit Gesetz, that means I was freed.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't put that state in here. Then here we have Abensee, 28th of May 1945.
It says here that it was liberated from the concentration camp Mauthausen.
All right. Mauthausen, as I mentioned
right,
to you, was the main camp, and Abensee was the satellite camp. And I was liberated in Abensee, which was part of the Mauthausen complex.
On the 28th of May?
May 1945.
And then what this side is, identification card?
Current number. Oh, this is my attorney number. I guess this must have been my identification number. That's my family name, my given name, born in the city of Mukachevo, nationality, Czechoslovak. And basically the same things as I told you earlier.
And who is
this?
This
was my signature.
Oh, that's your signature?
Yes.
Okay.
Looks a little different today.
Yeah, you dressed it up.
Yeah.
Did you ever go into a displaced persons camp?
Yes. After I came back from my hometown, we went back to Germany, and we wound up in a displaced person camp near München, in Gabersee. That's also not, and yeah, that's in Germany and Austria. Gabersee? No, it's Germany. Gabersee. That was not too far from München. And we stayed there. We got back there almost immediately, And we stayed there, I think from, no, first I went back to Czechoslovakia, to Prague. And then we went to Germany sometimes in the spring of 1946. Early spring, maybe late winter, early spring, 1946. And we got an affidavit from an aunt who lived at that time in Pennsylvania. And we migrated, we came to this country. We left Germany on July the 15th. We boarded our ship, the Marina Flasher, which happened to be the second ship that came here to this country with refugees. And we landed in New York on July the 25th, 1946.
Can I go back to the displaced persons camp? Can you describe it and your reaction to it?
Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe I'm making it too short.
No, you just aren't giving enough descriptions for the...
In the displaced person camp, of course, we were controlled by the American authorities. This was under American occupation at the time. We had... this must have been a military camp at one time. We were living in barracks. The we were beginning to live a normal civilian life. People were getting married, and some people were getting pregnant. Life was beginning anew. And actually, we just tried to really pick up our lives again. We started sport clubs. We played soccer. I played soccer there, and basically, we really didn't have much to do. We're just waiting. Everybody was waiting to go someplace, to find a place to go to. Some of us wanted to go to the States. Some of us wanted to go to Israel, and some wound up in South America. And we got dispersed. Some went to Canada. But everybody was there waiting to go someplace to start life anew. Basically, that's all there was to the displaced persons camp.
What was your reaction to it?
I thought it was a big improvement of what I had before. Actually, it was really not bad. Under those circumstances, it was really terrific.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great change for the better. But there probably 4 months, 5 months, something like that. Some of the people that had to stay there longer, of course, probably changed their opinions about the place, but I didn't have to stay there very long.
She had a good question. What made you decide to come to Detroit when you came to the United States?
Well, as I mentioned to you, we had an aunt who lived in Pennsylvania. She brought us out to this country. And we had some relations here in Detroit. And my father, of course, was a widower then. And one of our cousins knew of this lady who she thought might be a good wife for my father. And he came to Detroit and met this lady who was our mom, he loved very dearly. And he married her, and when he married her, we came to Detroit, my brother and I. And my brother today lives in Grand Rapids, and I live here in Southfield.
Do you know how old you were when you came, or when the war ended, or?
Yes, I was 18 years old when I was liberated.
So you were about 19.
And 19 when I came to this country.
when did you get married?
Well, this is my second marriage, and my first marriage, well, I was 29 years old, so that Let's do a little arithmetic.
That's 10 years after you came.
Pardon me?
That's 10 years after you came.
Yes, okay.
And where did you get married? Here in Detroit?
I got married in Detroit, yes.
Did you have any children?
Yes, and met one of my daughters. I have two children from my first marriage, and my wife was married before, and she has two children from her first marriage, and together we have four children.
Do they all live here?
Well, they're all grown up. Two of them are married. Our oldest lives in California. She is going to law school there. Mm-hmm. And Stephen, who is second, he is a graduate of Michigan State, and he is now doing graduate work at Harvard in the business school. And our third one, Sherry, who is my oldest, she just became a dietitian. She just got her diploma a week ago. And Anita is just starting college. She is 19.
Nice. Did you become a U.S. citizen?
Yes. I became a U.S. citizen after when the Korean conflict broke out, I was drafted and went into the U.S. Army and fought in Korea. And I should have become a citizen before I went there, but I did not become a citizen until after I came back.
And they took you in the Army?
Oh yes, they'll take you in the Army, yes. I have had my my first papers in at that point.
Oh.
And my intentions were, I was a legal immigrant,
mm-hmm.
who was going to become a citizen, and I was naturally eligible for the draft. I was drafted, and I fought in the U.S. Infantry in Korea. Don't like to miss out on anything.
So far, I haven't heard anything you've missed out on from the time you were born. What were your feelings and the initial impressions of the United States?
I loved it from the very first minute. They told us in Europe what a wonderful country it is, that all you gotta do is just walk down the main street and you can pick up money off the ground, and we did. We got to New York and my brother found a $5 bill, so we knew it was true.
A good omen. What problems did you encounter?
At first, I didn't have command of the language. It was very interesting when we first came to Detroit. We lived around Dexter then, and so we enrolled at Central High to learn English.
When you say we, is it your brother and you you're talking
My
about?
Father, my brother, myself.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. And we would go twice a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays, for 2 hours. And then when they interviewed us, when they to accept us to these classes, they asked us some questions. I'm sure they were pertinent, and of course we didn't understand what they were talking to us. We couldn't speak any English, so every now and then we'd say yes, and then we'd say no, and every now and then we'd get a funny glance from the interviewer. And we would go through our whole semester, and in the first hour we would get a class of arithmetic, and the second hour would be English. And we couldn't understand why we had to have arithmetic to learn how to speak English. Well, we found out at the end of the semester, we all got a diploma. We just finished the 8th grade again.
You learned the language very well.
Yes, thank you.
Do you recall any anti-Semitism?
Here in this country?
Yes.
No. I encountered a lot of problems as a young man when I came here. Socially, we were only able to socialize among ourselves. I'm speaking of the newcomers. The girls, they would have nothing to do with us. Well, you really can't blame them, because we couldn't communicate with them. We didn't have any transportation where they were used to go out with fellows who had a car or something like that. And so it took a little while, but eventually we overcame that.
How long are the two of you married? 15 years.
If there was no anti-Semitism, why did you change your name?
Yes.
Say
yes,
it loud
right.
enough.
I said, if there was no anti-Semitism, why did you change your name?
Well, actually, I don't think, perhaps it had to do something with anti-Semitism. When I first became a traveling salesman, which is my occupation, I worked for a local wholesaler from Detroit. And he started me out by calling on some accounts in the metropolitan area. And I didn't have any trouble. My name at that time, I had changed my name from Gino Mandel to Morris Mandel. As I went around and introduced myself, and I found that I was able to do business with the people. But then after about a month or so, 6 weeks later, my employer decided that I was ready to travel out in the state, and he gave me a territory mostly in the northern part of Michigan. And I went away for a whole week, and I came back with practically no business, and I inquired of him, I told him I couldn't understand that. I had really not much trouble selling merchandise in the metropolitan area, and I couldn't understand why I had all this trouble up north. And he told me that his opinion was that it must have been my name. And he said, maybe, when you go there, even though they know you're Jewish, when you throw it at them, you say, Morris, maybe that they might find that offensive. And so I asked him, well, what his suggestion was. Well, he says, the most common name is John Doe. And my name used to be Gino. I said, okay, well, why don't I just add John to my name? And I added that. That was before I became a citizen. So then when I finally got my final citizenship papers, I just added on to Morris. I just put in John, and that's how I became Morris John Mandel. And the interesting thing was that when I went back on my next trip and I started introducing myself as John Mandel, I didn't have much more success. It turned out that they didn't care for Catholics any more than they liked Jews.
Did you talk about your experiences?
At first, when I first came to this country, people would ask me about my experiences, and I would. And I would see all these incredulous looks on the people's faces when I would try to recant some of my experiences. And it suddenly occurred to me, after a while, oh my God, it really sounds so far-fetched. It must seem so strange to some people that the people would actually behave like that. They would perpetrate those kind of things on another person. That I thought to myself, my God, I can almost find that myself unbelievable, and how can I really expect some of these other people to really understand and believe what went on? And I, at that point, I stopped.
When they had the Nuremberg trials on television, we were not married, we were just going around together, and he came over and we were watching them. I don't know if you remember the program, but it was very vivid in descriptions. And I was sitting on the couch and literally sobbing out loud. I mean, I was just shaking. And he was sitting next to me, and he was completely unaffected. Absolutely, totally unaffected. And I said to him, how can you sit there and watch this? And he said to me, this is a picture. I saw the real thing. This can't hurt me. Now, many of his friends are not the same way. They cannot go and watch things like this, but that's the way he reacted.
Everybody reacts to this differently. I know my brother, his reactions, his feelings are entirely different than mine. He can't sit and look at things objectively. It's just too vivid. Things are just too vivid in his mind. Perhaps it's right, or I don't know whether it's good or bad, but I'm able to just detach myself from it, and I really don't let it bother me. And yet, certain things do affect me. Everybody, I suppose, gets affected by it a little different.
What affects you?
Well, as I told you, the end result of that particular episode when I watched the Holocaust, I was able to sit through it and watch the whole thing, and I didn't really affect me until the very last episode where the survivor of the family bonded over that brick wall, whatever it was there, and went on the soccer field and joined the boys that were going to Israel in the game of soccer. And to me, that meant that he's ready to begin life anew. And I just, at that point, I broke down, and I just completely lost control. But up until then, I was just sitting there watching the whole thing without, completely detached, just looking at it and with interest.
You told me that you played soccer in the displaced persons
yes,
camp. Could that have reminded you of yourself?
Well, perhaps. I played soccer here too. We formed a soccer team after we came over here. Generally, our social activities when we first came to this country were centered around the Jewish Center. At that time, the Jewish Center was located on Woodward and Claremont.
I remember.
And we formed a choir. And the soccer team wasn't existent. As a matter of fact, the coach of the soccer team, there was a Jewish soccer team called the Maccabees at that time. He came down to the Jewish Center to recruit players for his team. And he found a number of us that joined the team. And I enjoyed that. That was something that I liked to do. So maybe that had something to do with it. I don't know. Maybe I saw myself in that. It's very possible.